I'm Christopher Lydon with a musical extension on the memoir of a beloved teacher, the historian of Russia at Brown University, Abbot Gleason, known as Tom. We're connecting dots from Tolstoy to Orwell to Louis Armstrong in conversation with Tom Gleason in a big room full of friends at Brown's Watson Institute. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This time it's with and about everybody's dream of an intellectual mentor. There are touches of Mr. Chips about Tom Gleason, touches of his old friend George Kennan, and of my big brother and yours if you've got one. My thought is, if you assembled a dozen or so people of Tom Gleason's range and reading and curiosity and conversational talent, you'd have a university. A Liberal Education is the title of his memoir. It's the private side of a career in Russian studies coinciding with four decades of Cold War. It warms and deepens my pleasure in this book to have known Tom Gleason well from odd angles. Our daughters were college roommates. We've listened to jazz bands many Monday nights at Bovey's Tavern in East Providence. We read War and Peace together in a group 2 summers ago. Then Moby Dick last summer. Brothers Karamazov is next in summer 2010. Ted Widmer of the John Carter Brown Library asks the first question to Tom Gleason here after saying that Gleason's memoir reminded him of the education of Henry Adams, except that Gleason's book is about another century in America and that it's much, much funnier.
I was wondering if Adams was in your mind at all when you were preparing to write this memoir, and if not, which memoirist did you consult? Because it's very much a book about reading as well as about living.
Well, Adams was not in my mind, in fact. We do have certain things in common. Both of us found it difficult to teach at Harvard, for example. And we did study democracy and its opponents in Washington, D.C. No, I was actually not thinking of Henry Adams. My favorite memoirist, I guess my favorite memoirist is probably Vladimir Nabokov. I think Speak Memory is the most wonderful memoir I've ever read. Very close second to that, however, are two memoirs by Frank O'Connor, My Father's Son and An Only Child. And Irish stuff is gradually effacing all my other interests to the point where I get up and before I even make coffee in the morning, I put on a CD by Christy Moore and begin to refight the Irish Civil War or to attack the British for the famine or something like that. So, I guess those are three. Those are the three that come to mind at the moment. As soon as somebody asks a different question, I will immediately think of other memoirs that I've enjoyed. But I think Frank O'Connor to Vladimir Nabokov is Ireland to Russia. And that sort of, and more or less the extremities of Europe are my particular interest. Being a very, very moderate guy, of course, who likes extremes, to read about them at least.
Would Kennan's memoirs enter into that also?
Oh, Kennan's memoirs are very, very good. Yes, Kennan is one of the, I guess, the two most remarkable people who are mentioned in the memoirs that I actually knew well. And Kennan's memoirs were extraordinary. When I first met Kennan, I was trying to be a sort of young, radical young Turk and trying to be very lefty, not succeeding very well. I was too well brought up and too cowardly and too many other things. But when I met Kennan, I did think to myself, wouldn't it be fabulous to look that good in a suit and to speak that kind of beautiful 19th century Russian that he spoke? Because he was trained by people who learned how to speak the language in the 1870s and 80s. And he's an amazingly sort of self-created character and unlike anyone I ever knew. I think it's impossible, really, on mature reflection, to think of being or identifying totally with George Kennan, because he's an outre kind of person. He's a 19th century conservative thrown into a place in history where he, on the one hand, half invented the Cold War, and then at the end of his life entirely repudiated it. And that's in itself makes him one of the most remarkable men of the 20th century, and I do think he was.
You mentioned Ireland and Russia as passions. There's just one little passage in the book that I'd like to read. I just found it so beautiful, and it's New England and Russia. This is what I call you in your Connecticut Tolstoy moment. This is about the farm in Connecticut where the family used to repair, and Tom, as a boy, did a lot of the farm work. Indeed, almost everything there seemed at least a decade or two behind the times. Workhorses named Billy and Jerry and even a team of massive white oxen lingered long after tractors and hayloaders were the rule on the more serious farms in the neighborhood. All the men on the farm and many friends from Pomfret participated in the haying. Guest workers included the highly skilled woodcarver Gregory Wiggins, who made wonderful small carvings for my parents, some of which I still have. His masterwork was the marvelous choir stalls in the Trinity College Chapel in Hartford, which mingle carvings of St. Thomas Aquinas and Albertus Magnus on the pews with Babe Ruth and Dwight Eisenhower. I believe he did similar work at St. Paul's School. My grandfather's erstwhile graduate student, Jimmy Knowles, was also a charter member of this haying group. The haying was all done manually with pitchforks, and many a wobbly load slid or toppled off the wagon before it could be brought home to the barn. Farm work was usually over in time for drinks at the big house before the sun had sunk over the yardarm. It reads to me like Anna Karenina all over again.
Well, I certainly liked the passages in Anna Karenina where Levin was out there mowing hay and thinking about the peasants. Looking back at those days from here, the loads of hay may have slid off the wagon, but so did many of the people who assembled after 5 o'clock. So,
before or after the drinking?
It was not just the hay that was all over the ground.
Tom, here's my essay question for you. It has to do with the Cold War in memory. You were born into the Cold War in a certain sense. You kept your powder dry in it, but in the book, as in life, you observed all the high politics, low politics, fantasy politics, academic politics around the subject of what the hell it was all about. I mean, I want to ask you that sort of question that at the end of those Lone Ranger programs, you know, who was that masked man? What was that Cold War? Here's the simple way to say it, or the best way to say it, I think. Here and there, who got it right? Who had a view, including another wonderful child of the Cold War, Sergei Khrushchev, who, in retrospect, had wisdom on that huge subject?
Well, I'm not sure that getting it right or getting it more or less right and being wise are exactly the same thing. As far as getting it right goes, I tend to think I was a sort of left-center person on the Cold War, and I tend to think that in some ways the people on the two extremes, on the further to my right and further to my left, got it more interestingly, at least, if not absolutely more right. And by that I mean people like my colleague, the British historian Michael Cox, who teaches at the University of Wales, and his Trotskyite friends, always had a view that the Soviet Union was conceived in sin and betrayal, and it didn't really belong in the world, and it would one day pass away, and of course, from their point of view, be replaced by something which was truly revolutionary, as Trotsky had believed. And on the other side, my more conservative colleagues, Adam Ulam, Robert Conquest, Richard Pipes, also from a quite different point of view, believed that the Soviet Union did not belong in the modern world, because they believed that any nation or any group or any empire which denied the market and denied the economic realities of the world, would not ultimately survive. So in a certain sense, the two extremes met sort of behind my back, so to speak. And I think that in many ways, they were the people who were sort of least surprised, Martin Melia being another one of the conservative ones. But I think the two extremes were not necessarily the wisest people. I think the wisest people in dealing with the Cold War were those who tried to question their own motives and tried to question themselves and tried to take it one step at a time and never to go off the deep end and listen to the words that came out of their mouths and say, did I just say that? Could that have been, was that right?
For example, who are you thinking of?
Well, I don't have a specific statement in mind, but I do think the Cold War got us into places where rhetorical flights could take us out of ourselves and get us well beyond where we wanted to be. And once in a while, I would catch myself saying something, and my little super ego would sort of pick itself up and rub its eyes and say, "Have I been asleep all this time? Did I hear what you just said?" And I think other people. I don't have a good quotation. I used to feel that, I have to say, with my dissertation advisor, Professor Pipes, quite often. I don't have exactly the right quotation for you, however. If we ever get together again, I'll see that I'm provided with that.
But I guess the other part of my question is, and you deal with it, of course, in the book a good deal, is given the huge investment that the universities as well as the government had in Sovietology and criminology, Team A, Team B, and everybody else, why was the whole universe, including the specialists, so unprepared for the end?
Well, of course, nobody was prepared for the end. I mean, the Russians were not prepared for the end. The Americans were not prepared for the end. The Europeans were not prepared for the end. Nobody was prepared for the end. So I take that to mean that it was extremely hard to foresee what was going to happen. And as Mort Saul said so long ago in some club, nightclub somewhere, the future lies ahead. And, you know, most prophets who like to talk about what's going to happen tend to see tomorrow as being like today, only more so. And there's a sort of negative subset who like to look ahead and see the future as more like yesterday. So I find it hard to blame people for not seeing that the Soviet Union was going to collapse. And if somebody had said the Soviet Union is going to collapse or evolve dramatically into something completely different, and furthermore, it's going to do so with almost no bloodshed, I would have said, no, you're out of your mind. Nobody can believe that. Of course, if the Soviet Union were to relatively suddenly collapse, of course there would be bloodshed. And I would certainly have said that, and I believe that most people who studied the Soviet Union would have agreed with that. So all I can say is I never made any claims as a predictor of the future, and I make none now. And I think the best thing that most of us can do is to admit that we didn't know what was going to happen. And what happened surprised, I believe, everybody in the world. There's a wonderful book by a young assistant professor at Berkeley, which is about the last Soviet generation. And the title is Everything... Ethan Pollack isn't here, is he? The idea is everything was inevitable until it was no more. And I think that's how the last generation of Russians felt. And I'll sort of buy into a view, something like that.
Let me ask you the same question one more different way, and that is, do you have a sort of intellectual or literary or poetic hero of that whole saga that, you know, that you'd recommend to readers 100 years from now?
Well, certainly Orwell, who was a hero of mine from early on, and not at first even connected with the Cold War, connected with his wonderful essays. He sort of invented popular culture essays in some ways. And he was the first writer that I recognized to have a kindred spirit. And also the wonderful writer about southern Italy. Help me out, Chris.
Ignazio Silone?
Silone, who said when I was in college, after he'd been a communist and was still, of course, a very strong anti-fascist and was looking around for what kind of politics he wanted after World War II, who came out for a choice of comrades. And I was very struck by that when I first read it in the newspaper when he said it, and I've tried to stick with that one ever since. I go with the people and what they're like, and people's opinions come and go, but there are certain kinds of people like Ignazio Silone you can't help liking and can't help agreeing with.
Solzhenitsyn?
Well, Solzhenitsyn is a man of enormous moral courage. And his views are extraordinarily interesting, and they fit in with what I studied, which is the traditional conservative part of the political spectrum of Russians. And I can't imagine a braver and person of greater integrity, but I don't think like that. And I can't reject the modern world in the name of what seems to me to be a deep misrepresentation of the past, because I don't think the Russian Empire was ever anything like such a wonderful place as Solzhenitsyn worked himself into thinking it was. So I can't accept that. I'm a social democrat, and he thought social democrats were only a little bit better than communists. So he would certainly repudiate me much more vigorously than I'm disagreeing with him here.
Can we do a little something different?
Sure.
I just thought, because music is so incredibly important to Tom, if you visited his office, you know there's almost always a good horn player on the deck. But, you know, there's also a great deal of, I mean, one of the big stars of this book is John Harbison. And I simply thought, in the spirit of Desert Island Discs, it would be fun to just play a few pieces of music and ask Tom first to identify them. And then just riff on them. Take a 8-bar, 12-bar, 32 bars, as many choruses as you like, Tom, on the subject of the music that we're going to hear. There are just 5 short clips, and when you want to start talking, we'll take the music down. But let's start with number 1.
Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra. When I was a sophomore, I'd say lost my faith if my faith weren't so trivial that it was hardly something I noticed losing. I was a very shallow Christian at best. But this piece somehow seemed to me to sort of suggests some sort of neo-Stoic Albert Camus-like life that I was going to have. And as I tried to figure out where I was going to be and what I was going to do, and of course I dealt with it all at a sort of heroic fantasy level, the way adolescents do, this was the music that I constantly heard in my head, this piece. And I love Bartok, and this is not, in my old age, the piece I think is the best piece, but as a young man, I can't tell you how many times I listened to this.
In other words, if he hadn't written it, you would have.
Oh, I would have aspired to write it, Chris. That's my old roomie. That's John Harbison. And he was certainly the most remarkable person I met at Harvard, and was and is a very close friend. And it's an extraordinary thing to as a young person, to get to know a sort of a prodigy, especially when he's a prodigy who doesn't come in the costume that, you know, you do think of prodigies as dressed for it or somehow bearing some marks of the divine gift or being crazy or extravagant. But here was somebody who wore the same clothes that the rest of us did, ate the same food, made the same jokes, but when he was 6 years old, had written a symphony in the style of C.P.E. Bach, could play almost any instrument almost immediately, and when I knew him was writing music, which was sort of in a Bartok, Stravinsky idiom, and was a conductor as well as a composer and jazz musician. And I think knowing Harbison gave me a sense of what there was out there and started me off trying to aspire to something, trying to look beyond just being a college kid and sort of think, what could you do with yourself? How could you figure out something to do and then set yourself to do it. So he was a very important force for me, and we still see each other and still have contact, and I still follow his music pretty closely. But you know, when you're that kind of a person, when you have that kind of a vocation, whatever your vocation is tends to take you places and leaves you a little bit less time for hanging out. So I don't hang out with John as much as I'd like to. But he has things to do. I mean, we all have things to do. I have things to do too. I've got to walk Louis. Rooming with somebody at that level of talent was an enormous eye-opener for me and a wonderful, wonderful experience. This was the music of my sort of middle and late middle years, I guess it's appropriate to say, I just fell for John Coltrane and spent an enormous number of hours sitting in clubs in Boston and New York and listening especially to the music of the Coltrane Quartet with Elvin Jones and so on. And I've assembled quite a Coltrane collection. And I'm not sure I can very easily identify what is particular about Coltrane, except that to me it's like an extraordinary fountain of lovely sound. And it comes out of the bebop world, which was the sort of music of my time and my contemporaries. But it has a melodic quality which takes me back to the very, very early music that I first loved, jazz. Music of the New Orleans bands, Bunk Johnson. Because Coltrane is a sweeter and sadder and more sensitive musician than his hard bop contemporaries. And there's a kind of wistfulness and a emotionality about his music that also carried me along and jolted me out of my everyday concerns. And it's still wonderful to hear my favorite things. And of course tons of other Coltrane as well. And to think back to those days where at 2 o'clock in the afternoon I'd go in, get a beer and sit and listen for hours and hours and hours and not want to go anywhere else and not want to do anything and not even want to have more than a second beer, just to listen to those sounds and listen to Our Lady and Alabama and My Favorite Things and all of that great stuff. It's the middle period of Coltrane, starting maybe with Kind of Blue and Blue Train, when he's still with Miles, and on sort of through the sort of between sort of 1958 and about 1964, and Blue Train maybe is my favorite album. I love Kenny Drew's. That's the period of Coltrane that I like, and I have the poster, the cover of Blue Train, with Coltrane with a reed in his mouth, and that's up in where I'm trying to learn how to study in the attic. That's where old retired professors float up to the attic and eventually bump up on the ceiling up there, and that's where I am.
Rockin' chair's got me.
Old rockin' chair got your father.
Cane by my side.
Your cane by your side.
Fetch me a drink of water there, son.
No, it ain't no water you want, father.
For I tan your hide.
Gonna tan my hide.
Can't get from this cabin.
What cabin choking, father?
Ain't going nowhere.
You ain't going nowhere, no.
Well, of course, that's Pops and Jack Teagarden. And my first great jazz love was for New Orleans music, and especially for Louis Armstrong. And I always had a special thing about the music of 1947 when Pops got rid of his big band and came back with the All-Stars. And the most exciting, wonderful evening of all was one of the very, very early ones at Town Hall, the Town Hall concert, and Eddie Condon put together some Dixieland musicians to play with him, including another tremendous favorite of mine, Bobby Hackett, trumpet player from Providence. And when Jack Teagarden and Louis Armstrong sang Old Rockin' Chair, it did not make me think of my present situation or of old age, but rather somehow or other of endless youth and happiness, and especially of a certain kind of friendship, which was partly some idealistic projection of my own and partly a sense of what jazz meant by way of people relating to each other, musicians relating to each other. So Old Rocking Chair is one of my special favorites. Sarah and I have been reading Terry Teachout's biography of Louis Armstrong and playing all the music as we go along. And it's been great fun, despite the fact that Teachout's book is not the great Louis Armstrong book that we're still looking for.
Old Rocking Chair, get it!
Yeah!
Rocking Chair, get it!
Yeah!
And Judgment Day! Oh, Judgment Day, yeah, Judgment Day, yeah! You sit in your chain, you rocking chair!
Yes, okay.
That is the Basie Band, and the chart is by Neil Hefti, and it's called Little Darlin'. And my first year at Brown, I came with most of my, with I think maybe one lecture in the can, and two courses stretching ahead of me as far as the eye could see. That is to say, past Christmas in those days. And so I started more or less neglecting everything else and going back to my office at 8 o'clock in the evening. And just as I did, Fred Grady's jazz show came on. And Fred was one of those sort of cool, hip 50s, 60s jazz voices. And he checked in with a Basie arrangement of, what time was it? Satin Doll. And then he went all night. He went until 4 in the morning. And I would work on my lecture. And sometime between 12 and 2 or 2:30 I would fall asleep. So I would slump, usually sleep on my typewriter, which accounts for some if not all of my complexion problems. And I would wake up, I would wake up at 4 o'clock, night after night after night, to Little Darlin', and then I would get up and go home and get into bed, and sleep a couple of hours, and then get up and do it again. Fred Grady was a wonderful character. We used to meet and hang out at a sort of very seedy record store on North Main Street called Carl's Diggins. Thank you. And people would go there, and those were still the days when you had bins with sort of records that many of which were open and didn't have, were not sealed, and you could put them on. And Fred would come. I would see him there and other people, and that was my first acquaintance with the jazz world of Providence. I'm sure it was Fred who first said to me, "Man, you've got to go out to Bovee's." And that was before I knew Chris, and before I knew that when Chris used to do the 10 o'clock news in WGBH, he would do the news, and then he would sort of disappear off the stage as if he'd been hauled off with a cane, you know, one of those people reaching. And what I later discovered was the reason he left the stage so quickly was that he was down the stairs and into his car and on the road, almost almost before the sign-off to get to Bovies for the second and third sets. But Fred Grady was not really a pal. I didn't see him often enough. But I would call him up in the course of the evening and talk with him on WXTR, whatever little radio station he show was on. And he basically sort of saw me through my first year of lectures. And if it hadn't been for him, I don't know what my lectures were odd enough as it was, a cross between sort of somatic noises, stage fright, rampant boasting. But they were as good as they were largely because of the atmosphere and the mood that that Fred Grady projected into my office as I sat there night after night, and or ran occasionally to the Brown Library to discover that they didn't have the only book that would enable me to prove some tendentious point. Anyway, so Little Darlin is definitely a strong part of my early sense of Brown and what it was like here and what I was going to do, how I was going to get through it.
Last question for me, Tom. It has to do with the title and the L word. It's not a radical education. It's not a progressive education. It's a liberal education. And in the course of the book, you make it clear that it's kind of a difficult, sometimes awkward, sometimes indefensible position to put yourself in. And yet, in summing it all up, you wanted to call it a liberal education. I wonder if you just sort of unpeel that word and what it's meant to you today, originally, over the course of an education.
Well, I went through phases where I certainly thought liberals were all chicken. And I still think that, but I've sort of accepted it as my own badge of office. I'm certainly not a radical for a variety of reasons that are best left to me and my psychiatrist. And I'm certainly not a conservative, although I have conservative moments. And I'm certainly constantly veering from one side to another, which I think is kind of what liberals do. One of my many stern critics from the left, the Harvard Law professor Duncan Kennedy, once said, "Gleason, you're a classic liberal in that liberals are always at the mercy of they're always in a force field. So when things move, you move with the times, and you're always sort of in the middle." And I think that's been kind of true for me. And I don't have the depth of conviction to be a radical, and I don't have an adequate sense of veneration for the past to be a conservative. Because I hurt so many people's feelings when I was a nasty little kid, I don't like to do that, and I think liberals are famous for being too cowardly to hurt people's feelings. So I think by process of elimination, I'm sort of left being a liberal. And I thought I might as well sign up for the word since nobody else seems to be rushing to appropriate it in the United States of our times. And if I recognize it as being my general physiognomy, why not say so?
You've mentioned your being a difficult little guy, you refer to yourself as obstreperous and a pain in the neck, and you get bad report cards, and you act it up at home and abroad. You've been the most placid, serene, wise, gentle, gentlemanly guy in the world since I've known you. Where did the bad boy go? and you can leave that with the psychiatrist too, if you want. But I mean, I wondered, reading the book, who was this little devil?
Well, I don't really have an answer for that, but I think he's squashed down there at the very, very bottom somewhere underneath all of the mud. I still dream about being a fugitive, getting away, being chased, trying to escape. I haven't in the last couple, maybe since I retired, I haven't had this dream anymore, but I used to dream that I was in the Boston subway system. And I was trying to get to either Logan or some railroad station. And I was on the orange line. And I wanted to be on the red line. And I don't know, for those of you who've ridden the subways in Boston, there are places where the tunnels kind of almost connect, and you can look through and see somebody on one of the other subway lines. And I would, my wrong line train, my orange line train would stop somewhere, and I would look out through the gloom of the subway system and see a red line train in another station, maybe 20 or 30 feet away, but I couldn't get out of the car. And basically, by the time I succeeded in getting out of the car, that train had gone. So the whole business of not being able to get there, pursuing some goal that I couldn't define, and realizing again all over that I was late, that I'd failed, and that I wasn't going to make whatever connection it was, and I wasn't going to do what I was supposed to do, certainly brings me back to the sort of small child who regarded himself as a failure and was a failure and was a pain in the ass for everybody. So I think you exaggerate my serenity kindly. I'm kindly meant, I'm sure. But I certainly, the book is about the education in the specific sense that I think distinctly separates me from Henry Adams. I tried to become less of a jerk, and I'm not sure that rudimentary goal ever occurred to Henry Adams. And maybe that's a good note to leave it on. What would have happened if Henry Adams had said, "I must be less of a jerk, starting tomorrow"?
Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation with Abbott, known as Tom Gleason, at Brown University's Watson Institute. Special thanks to Karen Lynch for masterminding the event. Feedback, talkback on the Cold War, on Desert Island Discs, on liberalism and education at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.